The year was 2000, and George Pataki was governor of New York. Tim Carey was president, and indeed Jim Gill, who just passed away last week, was the chairman of Battery Park City. A committee was formed to basically decide what to do with a small circular area which was in the heart of the financial district in New York City. It was a no-brainer that the debt space should be used to memorialize not only the Irish hunger, the Great Famine of 1845 to 1852, but also to raise awareness of world hunger and world hunger today. There were to indeed decide what actually might be appropriate for that. Artists throughout the world were approached. More than 450 submissions from around the globe came to Battery Park City Authority. I was privileged at that time to be on a committee specifically for the establishment of a memorial to the Irish famine. One in particular came to the attention after a lot of sifting through artists' rendering and designers, again, many of whom, had world recognition. One in particular, one submission came from somebody who I got to know quite well and honored and happy indeed to call him a friend of mine. His name, Brian Toll, a New York artist, designer, an artist and designer who would develop the concept of the Irish Hunger Memorial at Battery Park City. It is my pleasure indeed, friends, to link with the creator of the Irish Hunger Memorial, Brian Toll. Brian, you're very welcome indeed.
Oh, thank you so much for having me this morning, Adrian, and hello to all of your listeners.
Thank you. Before we even start in this one, I was indeed complaining that we are dealing with 26, 27 degrees here in the city. yeah,
you, it's balmy.
you can top that because actually you're up in the Catskills, the famous Irish Catskill regions where you have a home. But
single digits, Adrian. Single digits.
Oh my God. Yeah, you need to be hardy for this kind of weather.
Yes, true.
That's true. Brian, as an artist, you and, as they say, you know, throughout the world, a concept for a relatively small place on the Hudson River in Manhattan, which is now designated for a memorial. And my God, when we even look at some of the renderings and some of the suggestions that came through, there, it was tough enough to sift through those and to try to come to some decisions. Yours knocked the committee and the selection committee really off the block.
Thank you so much for saying so.
No, it has to be, and it's true. But as we start there, it was, you know, even before your rendering, discussions on the concept were, for those of us who were not artists and designers, it was pretty hard to fathom. Maybe you could take us through that initial, thought process that you had with respect to how to use this space in the financial district, the shadow of then Twin Towers and currently in the shadow of the Freedom Tower in Manhattan. What did you have a clear concept from the beginning, or how does your brain work?
That's a good question, and many people have asked that. I'm not quite sure, but one thing I am very sure of is I don't start any project with a preconceived notion of what I might end up doing. Every project starts with pretty intensive research, and that research, you know, it might sound highfalutin, but that research might involve going on a trip and visiting Ireland and spending time talking to people whose families live through and experience the devastation of those times, or speaking with you, for example, or the committee, or Maureen Murphy, who was the historian who was dedicated to the project. But for me, it really started with actually going to Ireland, where I had never been previously. And Maureen pointed me in directions that I think were very, very influential over what the final design was. And I responded very directly to the western coast of Ireland, the place that was most immediately affected by the events of those years, and was moved by the desolation and the absence, the absolute absence of humans among these villages that had been devastated by hunger. And coming back to the States, I knew that there had to be some evidence of those places presented for this memorial. And the deeper that I got into it, and I think your point, your initial introduction, where you talked about, you know, the heart of the financial district, you know, the idea of creating a memorial acknowledging terrible events that could have certainly been, if not avoided, assisted in the middle of, you know, one of the wealthiest neighborhoods on the planet was very, very daunting and I think very, very powerful. At the time, the building to the south of our site, if you recall, was the New York Mercantile Exchange.
That's right.
Where all of the commodities in this country were being traded. And, you know, including, you know, pork belly and corn and oil and everything else that you can imagine. And the idea that those people working in those buildings would gaze out their windows and see something that represented a very, very stark reality to the one that they were experiencing currently was very, very important. So that's how it started.
In visiting Ireland, and I am delighted that you have acknowledged the great guidance of Dr. Maureen Murphy.
Good friend of both of ours.
Indeed, yeah. But okay, so now you have to present this, and if you remember correctly, even if those of us who were involved in that initial committee kind of had a bit of a brain freeze, saying, "Oh, geez, how is the power of the global financial world? How are they going to accept that something as poignant, something?" As deep and reflective of, a period of sheer starvation and that came very much to mind. And in fact, it was something that you plowed through with great aplomb, with great grace to point out to us, that this was absolutely appropriate, that this was not going, that this was not supposed to fit in,
Right. That's right.
In an area that represents wealth and power of
and the urban landscape. This is a truly rural landscape. And once I delved into the history of the famine, one of the things that becomes crystal clear, and I think this is the case in most, if not all, famines, is the politics of land and how the land is actually used, who has access to it, who has control over it, who owns it. And so I think, the committee and with the stewardship of Tim Carey understood mm-hmm. that they were setting aside an incredibly valuable piece of real estate. One that is still coveted, by the way.
Right. Brian, a property, I think it's good to note, that even a decade ago was valued at $1 billion, just the size, $1 billion.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah.
So to set it aside in that way, whatever artistic intervention was going to happen there, I think, was in and of itself significant. And I say artistic intervention because I think it's very important that your listeners understand, and this was a very radical assertion that the committee made, is that this was to be a work of sculpture, that this was to be a work of art, and not, as I like to call them, an architecture. And so the only people who were considered for the project were, in fact, artists. And it was the recognition that artists approach ideas differently than other design fields was critical to the success of the project, in my opinion.
Not only was that critical, it was indeed very much, and your presentation had to be taken in small doses, even for those who wanted, above all else. From once you came with the concept, it was, this is great, this is fantastic, but, and then you had to deal with the buts, which would follow. And
yes.
I think that then presenting the rendering, that was not only amazing, but it became clear that, in fact, there was not going to be an alternative, that all of the others, and there must be a sense of pride for you to know that, throughout the world, again, within the time frame, which was relatively short,
yes.
to have, more than 450, submissions from, again, as you say correctly, artists around the world. One would imagine, and at that point, that maybe a memorial that wasn't as in your face as what you came up with might be indeed a good move, and perhaps wouldn't rattle the community. But
yeah.
That had to, if you didn't recognize, the head scratching and the apprehension of that committee, well, first of all, I'm sure you did.
yeah.
But it was, this was something that was so great that many of what the issues that I've mentioned, if they had to be overcome, so be it. And ironically, the massive backlash from the financial district, from the residents and from the business down there, never happened. So it was it turned out to be, you know, our fears of that happening were unnecessary. But now you've got the plot, and now you have the land.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was your job to oversee every aspect of it. As a matter of fact, within the framework of that, you have a lifetime contract to indeed monitor every single aspect of it. And when, you know, now that the Irish Hunger Memorial has been basically, first of all, it was demolished and rebuilt, a lot of people who we meet along the way say, okay, so what's different this time? The answer is basically nothing. This is your creation. This is your design. So for those of you who visited and you saw that the Monaghan stone was way up from the top, and that the placement, that every single thing was to be as it was on day one for the opening in 2002.
Yes, and I think, not to sound overly legalistic about this, but the listeners should understand something about artists' rights. In the case of the Irish Hunger Memorial, Battery Park City Authority, who commissioned the work and built the work and cares for the work, owns the work. I, in turn, own the copyright for the duration of my lifetime, which means that any time the memorial is reproduced for profit, so let's say for a television show or for a movie or for an advertising campaign, Battery Park City can issue a permit for them to use their property, but they can't actually do it without getting my permission to use my copyright. Mm. And so what that does is that provides, and I think Tim Carey, once again in his wisdom, recognized that the most vested person in some ways, or the person who would have the knowledge in the future to make sure that the memorial was kept up in a way that was consistent with the original vision of it, was me. And so it's a responsibility that I cherish, but it's not one that doesn't come without a price. It requires a lot of energy on my part to make sure that people are treating it in a respectful way and that people are recognizing the importance of its maintenance. Now, here's an important thing that I think, again, the public should understand. Most monuments are built to last, right? Mm-hmm. they're designed in a way that they are enduring and durable. So they're made of granite, they're made of bronze, they're made of steel. That did not seem appropriate to me when I was conceptualizing a memorial to the famine, which is a historical, political, social event that was caused through a sudden failure of sorts, and the immediacy of that failure and the ripple effect of those events. And so the memorial to the famine had to be one, in my opinion, and this operates on many, many levels, is about nurturing it and maintaining it. And that means maintaining the character of the landscape, which is fallow and rural, and the plants that are planted there represent that, whether it be the maintenance of the text that surrounds the memorial at the base. All of that text was designed in such a way that it could be very inexpensively and easily updated and replaced over time, as famine, you know, migrates around the planet. And lastly, of course, the maintenance of the audio and the sound system that you were so instrumental in creating material for, that needs to be an ongoing process as well. I want people to hear other humans describing and expressing their concerns, anxieties, experiences with events such as those that inflicted Ireland at the time.
And now, just on that point, whereas the memorial, the Irish Memorial, Battery Park City, is open, and there was a little bump in the road there for a few months where it was open, and then it had to again be closed down because there were the flora, the planting, all of that had to be done, and in the interest of full disclosure, that the opening and the closing there had nothing to do with either yourself or myself. So
no. I mean, these are, it's one of the things that needs to be understood is that, you know, Battery Park City Authority is an authority in the same way that the Metropolitan Authority is an authority, and those positions are appointed by the sitting governor. And what that means ultimately is it's a position that's, you know, changes with the political cycles. Now, that doesn't mean that the people in charge are better or worse, you know, in terms of governance. But what it does mean is that their investment in one priority or another shifts. And over this, you know, 15 years that the memorial has existed, the priorities have shifted with different administrations. And when you put forward a proposition that says, you know, the idea behind this is that it has to be cared for in order for it to, you know, continue to be meaningful,
right.
You know, in the hands of one person, that's a beautiful idea. In under another administration, it might be a nuisance. So, these are negotiations that are ongoing. Now, in the case of Battery Park City Authority most recently, you know, they have taken on a very, very significant investment in the long term success.
A massive job, yeah. And I didn't get to mention that the audio, which again is a very significant component, and we've been, and the privilege that has been our corner of the project, that has not been, the new audio system will be shortly, we have to assume, that will be hooked up. And there were a couple of other areas, the limestone, the stone itself, that needs to be polished. There are a couple of outstanding issues which we have to assume will be taken care of maybe by the springtime of next year anyway. But I think it would be fair to say that despite 6-7 years of neglect, most of it, or some of it anyway, in fairness, had to do with the fact that, was Battery Park City going to continue to deal with structural repairs and whatever, or should it be again, taken down and rebuilt? There was a lot of obvious neglect of that for a number of years there. But it is rebuilt, Battery Park City, excusing the fun, left no stone unturned, in getting it back to its original and, since day one.
Yes.
And that must be very pleasing to you.
It's very gratifying to me, and I'm very appreciative for the quality of the work that they've done. What should be mentioned, and some of your viewers may know this, the original construction of the memorial occurred at and around the time of 9/11 attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we were scheduled, the biggest day on my project was September 12, 2001, when we were scheduled to pour 1 million pounds of concrete. That's the equivalent of 86 cement mixers, trucks. One after the other was supposed to come into Lower Manhattan, and we were to achieve that end. Obviously, that didn't happen because the Trade Center actually fell on the site and filled the wooden formwork with debris that had to be removed as carefully as we could under the circumstances. That said, that part of Lower Manhattan was considered a military zone, and any equipment, any materials, any raw materials for that matter, were to be used at the discretion of the military. And all of the heavy equipment that existed on the site at that time in preparation for this big day was in fact confiscated for rescue. The military also began to pull away at the wooden formwork that was built to support the concrete that was never poured on September the 12th. And in fact, I think we've spoken about this, Adrian.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Irish firemen, cops, EMTs, who sort of casually came around over the course of the building of the memorial, you know, because of Adrian's program and the Irish newspapers. These people had been given tours by me personally over the course of its development, and it was those people who told the military, who had no knowledge of what this place was, not to do it,
right.
To basically stop, don't destroy it. And frankly, if they had removed that formwork at the time, we might not have moved forward. So we owe a great tribute to those men and women for having saved it.
Absolutely.
Now that said, the problems that have been corrected were in fact problems that were caused on that day.
Mm-hmm.
The debris that got trapped in there and the way that the memorial was ultimately finished in order to save it didn't necessarily didn't meet the specifications that were required for it to survive over long periods of time. And we addressed that at the time, and the powers that be were very clear. And so, let this pass, let's recover from this horrible incident, and we will address it at the appropriate time.
Yes.
And that has now happened 15 years later. But let's not make any mistake. It was a problem that was created from the get-go as a direct result of a terrorist attack on Lower Manhattan.
You were at the site.
Yes, I was.
On the site on September 11th.
That's right.
And just describe for us what your feeling was. You're on the site. This is going to be the Irish Hunger Memorial. You're working on it. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of headway made at that stage of the game.
Oh, we were doing great. Yes.
Yeah.
We had great leadership. You know, I wasn't necessarily, I mean, I'd never, you know, worked, that closely with, you know, a person of Tim Carey's stature.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, he was a very, very direct leader and a very, very responsive leader. And when he said things needed to be done and they had to get done, they got done. And I had a direct line to him at all times. And if something was going wrong and if there were things that were being done that I didn't approve of, I would pick up the phone and I would call the president. And he would make things happen for us because he understood that when he asked me to design this thing or to create this thing, it was a one-year design build. I mean, it was a clay model and some renderings. And his mandate was get it built within a year. Which, if you think about it, it's not exactly a simple task.
Yeah.
So my way of doing things is very, very consistent. And that is that I like to know, and this I think is proven out in our friendship, I like to get to know the people I'm working with. And so, if somebody knows you and if somebody knows that you care about the work that they're doing, the likelihood of you getting a better end result is far greater. And so I got to know all of the men and women who were working on the Irish Hunger Memorial because I was there every single day. Mm-hmm. I got there when they got there and I left when they left. And on this particular day, 9/11, the canteen would pull up, you know, typical coffee truck would pull up every single day. And I didn't much like the coffee at that canteen. It made me sick one day. And, so I would get up and I would go to the Dunkin' Donuts at the World Trade Center. And, I would literally just, the truck would pull in, all the men would stop working, women would stop working. And that was my signal to go and get my Dunkin' Donuts coffee. Well, this particular morning, a man that I hadn't met yet, his name was Vance, walked over to me with a cup of coffee, and he called me boss because they'd all gotten in the habit of calling me boss. And he said, hey, boss, here's a cup of coffee, no sugar, right? And I said, that's right. And he said, my name's Vance. I'm one of the new Masons on the job. And so I sat down and drank coffee with Vance instead of walking over to the Trade Center. And within a few minutes, the first plane hit the building.
When that plane hit the building,
yeah,
you had to know, that this had a direct, this was going to have a direct, the impression, on the Irish Hunger Memorial. This was not something that was off in the distance. You're talking about one block away.
One block. That's right. Well, the truth of the matter is, having seen it enter the building, my initial reaction was to run and hide, frankly. So I ran underneath the formwork, the wooden formwork, and waited because having seen that and understanding, you're trying to process something in a very, very short period of time. You're watching a huge silver airplane approach a building and hit it. My brain was trying to understand what happened, and I knew that whatever happened was not correct. And whatever happened was probably not an accident because there was no indication that there was any distress. There was no, the plane was not, mm-hmm. Wobbling or smoking or any of those things. It wasn't a plane crash. It was a plane that crashed into a building intentionally. And my mind went one step further and said, okay, what's that plane carrying? So if it's going to the trouble of hitting a building, what's going to happen next? Will it explode even further? And so I hid underneath the formwork. And then after that passed, of course, like as everyone tried to do, I tried to make phone calls out. And, cell phones were not working. And I managed to get a landline in the construction trailer. And I couldn't call anybody in town, but I was able to get through to my parents, who at the time were living out on Long Island. And they, they're retired, and they picked up the phone over, their morning coffee. And I explained to them what was going on. And it was while I was on the phone with them that the second plane hit. And, it shook the entire construction trailer. So my first experience with the first impact was all visual. And I actually have no memory of what that sounded like. But the second one, because I wasn't actually seeing it, was all about the incredible sound of the explosion. So I have two very different sensory relationships to the two events. And then, then it was complete chaos. No one really knew what to do. And when we finally decided it was time to leave, my construction manager at the time, a guy named Steve, he was locking the gate as we left. Mm-hmm. And the two buildings are consumed with fire, and all hell's breaking loose. And he turned to me and he said, "I'll see you tomorrow for the big pull-up."
I want to, again, bringing us that close, an act of terrorism, an act of war. Maybe it's appropriate that we got to talk about this on today, Veterans Day. I would like, though, for those who haven't seen, haven't visited, or for that matter, haven't even seen images or photographs or anything of the Irish Hunger Memorial, tell us how you would help describe. You've done so many tours of the Irish Hunger Memorial, but for somebody who just has arrived, you know, on North End Avenue, on VC Street there,
yeah,
tell us how you would take that person, that group, and give us a brief synopsis of how you would describe your creation, the Irish Hunger Memorial of Battery Park City.
I'll try the best I can. I think that one of the most the greatest compliments that I received in the press was from a writer named Verlin Klinkenborg at the New York Times. And the thing that impressed him the most about the Hunger Memorial was, and this is, I think, a pretty accurate quote, was that it trusts the intelligence of the visitor. And I'll take it one step further. So the experience that you'll have, for those who haven't visited, is that the memorial has two very distinct features. One is, as you approach it from VC Street toward the Hudson River, you see this rural piece of land with stone fences and a stone cabin, and it seems startlingly out of place. The memorial touches ground on the southeast corner, but beyond that, it's completely elevated and suspended on top of a base made up of limestone and language. And the language is presented in a way that I'm actually quite proud of, because it was the thing that made me most anxious about the design, because the committee required that I provide a place for historical inscription. And, you know, as an artist and not a historian, I felt very anxious about being the person asked to officiate over these very, very contentious historical events, right? And so for me to say, this is in 2002 or 2001, these are the facts, this is the truth, forever to be, carved in this stone, didn't sit well with me. I didn't want the responsibility of that. And so, and it was a great source of frustration for the people who were building it, because I couldn't figure out what I wanted or how to do it. And so the solution, the short-term solution, was to leave spaces for it, which meant we left blank spaces in the base, and we arranged them in a way that was appealing visually or interesting visually. And then it became, okay, let's put glass in those placeholders, right? And so then there was, okay, maybe we'll etch the glass. And I thought, well, no, the etching is the same thing. It becomes permanent. And then, as a total fluke, the graphic designer came in one day and he showed me the typeface and the size of the lettering that he was wanting to use, and he glued it to the back of the piece of glass for me to look at it. And what happened was the light behind it cast shadow on the face of the glass, and I knew instantaneously that's the answer. We don't have to make anything permanent here. It can all be printed on clear plastic, plexiglass, and lean behind the stonework and cast as shadow, which means that we can change it indefinitely. So anyway, as you move into the memorial, go around toward the riverside, everything is about the cantilever. Everything is about the weight of history. Everything is about this huge slab of concrete that you will feel pressing down on you as you enter into the passageway. Now, the passageway is directly inspired by Newgrange and the great Irish ancient passage tombs, at the end of which there, you know, you go to a passage that's usually oriented east-west, which that passage is. And when you arrive in the tomb chamber, there's oftentimes a light that comes down, and it behaves at different times of the year to mark different times of the year. Well, in this case, I've replaced the tomb with the cottage. And so when you enter the passageway, you arrive in this house. And these houses, as you know, Adrian, were oftentimes the mausoleums for these families. The house is made of stone, but the roof would have been made of thatch. And you know the proverb, when the fire goes out, the thatch falls in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that had a very practical meaning before the famine. That meant that you kept the fire burning, it kept the thatch dry, and it kept the, you know, family warm and safe. But the fire is not being tended to because everyone in the house has perished. The roof will certainly fall in. And many of these Irish families, you know, the last person to survive was buried under the thatch. So the tomb became synonymous with the house. And then as you move through the landscape, you find yourself in this rural place with 50-odd indigenous Irish plants, many of which your listeners might consider weeds. but we've been very, very respectful and mindful of the character of the plantings. I can guarantee you that although there are drills there, there has never been and never will be a potato planted on that plot. This is a place of loss and abandon.
Brian, we could and we will continue our story about the Irish Hunger Memorial, but we do have to cross to Ireland for Kevin O'Connor to bring us news and sports. You know, let's continue this on another day, because the story, again, is it's well worth hearing, and your description so far of your own creation is amazing. Suffice it to say, maybe at this point we can, you know, get that message across that the Irish Hunger Memorial is open, and anybody is encouraged to come. As again, the shuffle over, it's open, it's temporarily closed. That part is finished. And
that's all finished. And you know, there's still going to be a few tweaks, as we mentioned earlier in the program. Rest assured that the future health of the memorial is secure, and I'm looking forward to seeing it fully realized.
Brian, there will be a part two. There'll be a part three. but I want to thank you on this, you know, on this day in particular, Veterans Day, as indeed we commemorate, you know, the those who fought and died, so that we can be free.
No question about it. Was,
you know, that massive terror attack. With you a block away. Very important that we got that part in, and we will continue. I'm glad to know you and delighted to know you as a friend, and congratulations on the rebuilding of the Irish Hunger Memorial in Battery Park City. We will continue, Brian.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
Okay.
And always a pleasure.
Thank you. And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.